Welcome to Two Men in the Middle, Democracy in Flyover Country. From here, we'll discuss today's topics from a Midwestern perspective, with our boots firmly on the ground in a red state. I'm Mike McCammon.
I'm Craig Huey.
This week's topics, America is Great Again, Parkland and Kanye West.
There's a Parkland and Conway West.
Well, that's the Parkland, is that what the kid that decided to go to the shooting range and do a YouTube video about it?
Did a little Twitter video of him shooting an AR-15. So we've started like the last 3 weeks with candidate updates.
I think this is just your way to kind of lure me into like waking up and having a conversation.
This is my way to get you involved and kind of get your juices flowing, so to speak, to get into the conversation.
I think exactly 1.5 hour ago, as you got into your car to drive all the way out here, or even after you were on the freeway driving all the way out here, my alarm went off and I realized I needed to get up and get out of bed.
So. There was like a 30-second delay this morning when I rang your doorbell. And usually you're right there because early in the morning. This was the first time I thought, uh-oh, I'm going to have to call Mike and get him out of bed because he's not here.
Yeah. Well, I don't really have a three-point bullets here for how the campaign's going. I would say that it's going really well. You know, the strategy that we're using, I think, is the right strategy. You have to kind of, you know, I was telling a pastor that I met with earlier this week, and we were talking about, actually, he had some really great things to say. When you're a kid, you memorize Psalm 23, and there's this little part of like, even though I go through the valley of the shadow of death,
I shall fear no evil.
Exactly, something like that.
I know that one because it's on a lot of war movies.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Well, it's applicable to campaigns too. So there's this... someone asked me the other day, and I said, you know, I'm a big fan of the 80-20 rule. So let me say that 80% of it is actually really, really interesting and really, really enjoyable.
Yeah.
And then 20% of it is just not very much fun at all. And all of the 20% that's not fun is related to making, you know,
it's fundraising.
Trying to find ways to cajole people and to give you money.
Isn't that like the most unnatural act?
It is a very unnatural thing.
Anytime I've had to ask somebody for money outside of like a sales situation, it just seems kind of like,
well, and the worst part is you know, the quote unquote the easiest money to get is from your friends, which now is even more uncomfortable, you know, because you're asking.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it's and the thing
it's like
is,
you're selling Amway or something.
Yeah. And really the pressure to raise money is, it's both, there's an artificial version of this and there's the real version of it. So the real version of it is you need to have some money to run your campaign, to have a little bit of help, you know, to, you know, and I, by the way, I'm doing this like on the cheap, you will not believe.
Yeah.
And so you don't have to raise that much money, but the artificial pressure is this, like, the way the party and the insiders and the pundits and the paper report about it is, well, how much money have you raised? And all of a sudden it's like, well, if you haven't raised a lot, then you're not a viable candidate.
That's the bar for success.
And I'm like, I was telling someone
success.
The other day, it's like, you know, you take the person who has raised the most money, and he's sitting in the race, and let's see, that person had, well, the point is, well, actually, I won't even pay. Actually, what I'm trying to change the narrative is, how much money have you spent? And let's have a conversation about how efficient these people are being about spending their money as a way to kind of like talk about, should you invest more money in their campaign?
And voters don't give you points for that, do they?
No.
Making that, listen, I'm efficient with my campaign money.
No,
that
not.
Could be an indication of my governing style.
And I told them that when I worked in the nonprofit sector, like, efficiency was a big thing.
Absolutely.
You know, like, one of the charts you always put on your website was, well, how much money of our money goes to programs.
Yeah.
And like, if you spend more than 15%, take that back. If you spent more than 5% of your money on fundraising and admin, they said, well, you're a very inefficient nonprofit.
Yeah.
And you know, you take these campaigns and the person who has spent the most amount of money in the campaign, you can go look it up, or it's on the web. You know, he's spent like $200,000 so far.
Just in this stage, he has spent more than $200,000.
From the day he started until March 31st, he had spent over $200,000. I have spent, now I've been in the race for a very short amount of time.
Yeah.
I'd spent $6,900.
What has he spent $200,000? I'm sure you can spend $200,000. You could do some mailers print material and rack up some serious costs.
Andrew Ramsey, the woman that did withdraw from the race,
she
had spent $225,000 in her abandoned campaign. And when I dug into where she'd spent her money, is basically 80% of that was on staffing and consultants.
And so
people to basically to, you know.
That's true.
Well, I told someone the other day, like, you know, I've looked at a couple of these reports, and you know, they'll go spend $9,000 standing up a website. And I'm like, well, I did that for free. Like, it's my time. You know, and if I would have build the company for that time, it would have been a fair amount of money. But
and you talked about taking that startup mentality. Your biggest burn is always your people.
Right.
So if you want to burn through a ton of cash, go hire three or four people.
We were at a candidate forum over at KU, and one of the candidates wants to basically sit there and brag about, well, I've had a field director since, you know, a year, and we've got a great ground. I'm like, great ground game. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I guess maybe, you know, he'll probably win. Who knows? I don't know. But it's just the weird thing is that they're not reporting. I want them to start talking about how people are spending their money and what they're spending their money on. Because I've told people this. I said, you know, look, we all sit around and bitch about how much we hate campaigns and we think we need to reform campaigns and there should be no money in politics. But wait a second. The article you want to write is about how much money we've raised. Yeah. Like this, or if you're a politician, you want to brag about how much money you've raised. Well, guess what? This is contributing to that problem. You know, don't be a hypocrite. Don't sit here and tell me one thing and do another thing. And
so
I'm actually my blood pressure is going up because that's when I get pissed off.
See, this is where you get into the pod.
Okay, I'm sorry. This is where
you're
I take
fully
over.
Engaged. Now. If you can see, Mike, he's standing arms crossed, square, like I'm ready to go.
Exactly.
So somebody asked me the other day. Somebody asked me, "How's Mike polling?" And I'm like, "I don't think they do polls at this
point." Well, I think. I don't know. What I've been told is they do, but I've also heard that. Well, and again, this is just a complete rumor that I'm just hearing off the campaign trail. Is that it sounds like the National Party is not as interested in this particular district now as they were some time ago.
Have they made some sort of calculation that it's
safer? Well,
the Democrats or the Republican National Party?
No. I'm talking about the Democrats.
Okay.
The rumor that I've heard is that. While a couple of the people in this district want to brag about how much money they've raised, you know, the person who's raised the most amount of money has raised like a third of what, or
you
a quarter.
You ain't ever going to outraise Kevin Yoder.
Well, no. That's not it. The issue is the person that's raised the most amount of money has raised like a quarter of what they would think that person should, the front runner in this race should have been able to raise.
I gotcha.
So I think they're feeling like maybe this race is not as winnable
because of the lack of funding or
the lack
fundraising.
Of funding.
Yeah.
And knowing full well that, you know, and if you're the National Party, you got 400 and some odd races to keep an eye on.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, which 25 you're going to, you know, spend your time on.
So you think as they're putting their stack rank together.
Yeah. We're not
stack
Kansas
ranking.
Kansas third is not as high as
by
it
dollars.
No, I don't
people
doing that
you think
way.
Are raising the most, therefore they're most winnable.
Again, I'm just totally making this up, but I think winnability, I think how much money the candidates are raising. The fact that we have six folks in this field means the money's being spread around, and this could be a little bit of a battle before we get to the finish line. I also think that if you're sitting in D.C., you think, oh, wait, the only thing I know about the Koch brothers, in addition to they spend a lot of money, is they're from Kansas.
They're from Kansas.
So the assumption is that, you know, I tell folks, and I've told them over and over again, when we get to the fall here, it's going to be fire and fury. I mean, like, the amount of money coming from the other side.
It's on.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, and I've told people that. As I said, you know, in the campaign trail, I'll say, look, here's the deal. When we get there, we're never going to have as much money as the other side.
No.
Okay, so we need to figure out how to be smart about doing this now. So that's the diet I'm on, is to be smart about how to win the primary, because I'm going to learn some things that are going to help me be successful in the fall. Because if I just come in here and just, you know, do it the way everybody else does it, and realize I need a lot of money to go do this, well, that formula is not going to work when you get to the fall.
I'm waiting for the day I come to the Men in the Middle studio,
blah, 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 blah.
AKA Mike's basement, and it's full of cubicles and office equipment as your staff is here now running your campaign.
That's never going to happen.
I don't think that's going to happen.
That's not going to happen. No, I can't really figure out a way. Well, I could figure out a way to have three or four people, but, you know, it's just... You know, you've heard very few people on the podcast probably have heard the Mythical Man Month. Have you ever talked about that? This is a tech thing.
Very few folks, I think, have heard
the
Mythical Man Month.
What's the name of that book?
It's called the Mythical Man Month, isn't it? Yeah. Pretty sure it is.
Yeah, I think you're right.
There's a book called the Mythical Man Month.
Well, so it went around. This was really popular about 25, 30 years ago when I was first in tech. Have you seen the book? You know what the concept is?
Yeah.
Yeah. So for those that don't, basically the simple version of this is that if there's a project and it's going to take 100 hours, I'm going to do the math easy here. If it's going to take 100 hours to get something done, hiring 100 people to spend 1 hour on it doesn't work.
That doesn't work.
In fact, actually, the more people you add to a project, the higher the coordination costs, which actually makes the project take longer.
The slower it goes.
It's actually more efficient to have one person work 100 hours on it than it is to have four people work 25, because now you got to add another 5 to 10 hours of coordination time. And when it comes to complicated things like software engineering, it makes a lot of sense, because these things are obviously kind of interconnected, and there's complexities and things that and yeah. that you know, just require a lot of coordination if it's not all in one person's brain.
So I've also the general rule of developing software: the most engineers you can have on a project is 3. That is the absolute max, and that is very difficult to pull off.
Yeah, I that's actually probably about the right number for most projects we've worked on.
Yeah.
But I would say that, well, I have a good friend. He used to always use it. He called it the 2-pizza rule. So his view was that no problem can ever be solved by a group of people larger than that can be fed by 2 large pizzas. Well, so if you have more than 12 people, like, things just start getting weird. So in a company, let's say, like a startup.
So, Mike, we talked about coming down here today that we have a large and growing contingent of high schoolers that listen to our podcast.
Yeah.
So,
what is the draw?
So, well, it's us. It's the information we give, Mike.
Oh, well, no, wait a second. Teenagers never listen to me talk ever.
And it's the fact. Well, your own don't.
What's that?
There's the concept of your own teenagers don't, but other teenagers do. And it's the fact that any teenager that enters my house, I demand their phone and subscribe them to our podcast.
Well, that probably
it's marketing,
a lot of it.
Mike. I mean, I know that's your specialty, but you know.
I've never considered taking the device out
it's
of
called
their
blunt
hand.
Force trauma marketing. Okay. If you want to eat the $15 worth of food you just took out of my fridge, give me your phone. I'm going to subscribe to the podcast.
That's a good strategy.
I was just saying, but to that crew, we can give them some life wisdom right now. Anytime when you join the real world and you go to your first adulting job,
yeah, I was gonna
right?
Say, uh-huh.
When you start adulting, everybody's estimate on everything about how much time something takes is a completely made up, completely false, and absolutely has nothing to do with getting the project done.
Well, I will say, and I don't want to digress into a podcast about the philosophy of work here, but I would agree with you that generally speaking, estimates for amount of work that happens are usually off. But I would say that I will give some folks a little bit of leeway, because I think what happens is that the scope of what you're doing changes, and there's no discipline a lot of times to stick to the original plan. So it's not that like you're wildly wrong in your estimate. It's just that you're wildly wrong in anticipating the things you don't know, and you have no discipline. And companies are terrible at this.
Yes.
You have no discipline to say, oh, I just had a great idea.
Yeah.
We're not talking about that.
We talked about that last week.
This is the bucket list.
The good ideas are what kill you.
Put it on the bucket list. We're not doing that.
My favorite phrase is perfection is the enemy of done.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of that.
I always tell people, too, there's 2 types of people at work.
Perfect, yeah, is the enemy of done.
There's people who talk about working, and there's people that do things. And you have to separate those 2 groups. You can't allow those 2 groups to intermingle. Everybody can do a certain amount of talking, but when it's time to go do something, those people have to go do something. And regardless of whatever project you're on, there's usually 1 or 2 people that end up putting their shoulder to it and pushing it forward.
Yeah.
Everybody else is doing some sort of admin function or reporting. There's 10 people reporting on what the 2 people are doing that are actually doing the work.
Well, sometimes you got to sit down and put your fingers on the keyboard. That's how that works. That's the only way something gets done.
At the end of the day, someone's got
to
do something.
And I used to joke with my developer friends, and they know that I'm completely joking with them, when I used to always say, I think part of our problem is that the developers just need to learn how to type faster. That's actually what they just need how to do.
We've got to switch to why America's great, because we could go an hour on the current state of
software
engineering. There's a whole series of
a podcast,
and we're losing our high schoolers already. They're already finding something cooler to listen to as we talk about this.
All right, well, let's talk about why America is great again. I'll let you run down your statistics. Do you have them handy?
I do, Mike. I don't know if they're stats more as they are observations.
Okay,
so. I was driving the other day. I was listening to something, and I think I was listening to MSNBC, and they were talking about kind of some indicators right now that are out that show kind of where America is at. And so when this topic gets keyed up, you immediately start thinking, oh my God, this is going to be talk about how bad something is or how much something sucks. And it was a whole segment on there are some indicators right now that show America is in a really, really good place. Some things have massively improved, are continuing to improve. And by a lot of indicators, quality in life in America is pretty good. Number one, The Atlantic came out with a study that the child poverty rate is as low as it's been since the 1950s. The overall poverty rate in America has dropped to, I think they said like a 48-year low. The number of people who live permanently below the poverty line is the lowest it's been in the United States in the last 50 years. We talk about crime and we talk about our murder rate. We have spent an inordinate amount of time talking about guns and violence on this show. The reality is,
right,
violence in America and the murder rate in America is plummeting. New York City is on pace to have its fewest murders ever in recorded history. New York City is on pace to have fewer murders than London. That is the first time that has happened in recorded history.
Right.
We think of London as a city that has some of the tightest gun control in the world. We think it as that kind of Western European kind of. We just see London very differently than New York.
Right.
And the fact that New York is really becoming one of the safest large megatropolis cities in the world, that's something kind of showing where we are, isn't it?
Well, you know, I don't know. You tossed it at me. I wasn't really ready to respond.
I'll give you a few more so you could bowl.
No,
over.
It's. I think that, you know, I'm thinking about it. And I'm not sure how to respond. The thing that has occurred to me is that people that I meet all the time, and I'll tell you what, I mean, the one thing I am an expert on now is I talk to lots and lots of people, way more. Yeah. You know, when you get into your life of work, you know, you go from place to place and there's kind of a routine and there's a group of 20 people.
Yeah.
There's like 20 to 50 people that you typically see in a day, and it's the same 20 to 50 people
every day.
And I've really been forced out of that, you know, cycle that basically every day I'm meeting new people and talking to folks. And when I the sense I'm getting and the thing I've been trying to sell folks on is that 80% of the time, about 80% of us agree on a lot of things. It's just that for some reason we always want to focus on these edge things that make us afraid or make us think that, you know, that the Republic is at risk, all that kind of stuff.
Does
that
make any sense? The wedge issues.
Yeah, and I think that there's a conspiracy in a way that, you know, you're not going to turn on CNN and watch it unless there's, you know, some shit show going on. Like, because if it's you know, it's like we used to always joke, why do you watch the weather when we lived in San Diego? Like there's nothing on the news during the weather segment that's new from yesterday.
Yeah.
Because it's always the same.
Rinse, wash,
repeat. It's going to be 50 degrees this morning, 78 in the afternoon, and it's going to be sunny. And then if it's between the months of January and March, the only variation is it's going to rain today. I mean, that's basically the only difference. So again, if that was CNN when it came to politics or any of these issues, like they wouldn't have a business.
True.
But so let's go find stuff to report on that is crazy or ridiculous or, you know, whatever, to get people scared or whatever the case might be, just so I raise my viewership, if that makes any sense.
Unemployment rate is dropping under 4%.
Well, the thing, I get nervous about the unemployment rate because the one factor about the unemployment rate is that it's a measure of people that are actively seeking jobs.
True.
So it is not necessarily, I think, a good indicator of prosperity or lack thereof. I think it's just a measurement of how many people are currently looking for a job.
But we can say that a lower unemployment rate is more desirable than a higher unemployment rate.
Well, it depends. I would say that generally that is the case, but the one nuance of that, of course, is that if people stop looking for a job, they fall out of that statistic.
True. The job market is better now than it was 4 years ago.
It's quite likely. And then the other thing,
looking for that 80% we're going to agree on this topic.
Right. Well, and that's just sure. You know, and the thing that, you know, the other thing we have to talk about too, and it sounds like I'm defending now Obama, but, you know, business cycles also don't, you know, occur in, you know, in 12-month cycles.
Absolutely.
These are long, these are long things. Long arcs. You know, the metrics you're looking at today may reflect kind of the world of a year ago.
Well, the stock market continues to go up. It has some fluctuations as Trump does some silly stuff, but the general trend is that the market is generating more value.
So what do? We put a bow on this and call it done. Like, America is great again.
The point I'm trying to make here is that there's a lot of things that, if you look at culturally where we're at and some of the indicators around violence, around crime, that are going in the correct direction. For all of the talk that we've had about guns and gun violence, gun ownership in America per person is actually shrinking. The economy, depending on what definition you use, is approaching that full employment number. We've always heard somewhere about 3.2% is about full employment. There's always going to be a percentage of folks that are looking for a job. That's happening. Wages are slowly, not to the extent that I think everybody would like to see them, they're starting to come out of that down cycle. People are starting to kind of build.
So what? And I kind of have an answer for this, so it's somewhat rhetorical, but I'd like to get your opinion first. So what is wrong with this country these days then? Why does it feel like it's really broken still? If all these, you know, kind of these metrics seem like they're at historical highs.
Yeah.
What is wrong?
I think part of it is what you said. How do you report this? How does this news crack the constant news cycle that we're in right now, where this week felt like a really slow week, right? I mean, usually we start this podcast off and there's 9 things to choose from.
We had to dig around to find Kanye West.
Dig around a little bit this week. I think part of it is just because what oxygen is left in the state that we're at right now, that stories like this and something other than the latest scandal, the latest disaster, the latest potential impeachable offense or whatever, there's just no room left.
I think it's that, but I think there's also a high degree of fatigue on that story.
I think there is too.
I mean, it's just like, okay, like we said last week, every week there's a new breaking news alert on CNN that this is it, Manafort's got this, and we're done. And then that's not true.
Last night was Cohn pleads the Fifth.
Exactly.
And it's like, okay, don't know what any of that means because he hasn't gotten to the stage yet where it's applicable. But
you got to report about it before it happens so you can break the news, and you got to report about after it happens, and then you got to spend a whole night talking about why it happened with all the commentators.
So you've known me enough to know that I have a tendency to communicate in extremes.
Oh yeah.
It's you know, we've talked about nuance and we've talked about shades of gray. It's just easier to go to the extreme. This is totally wrong. This is totally right. This person is an idiot. This person is a genius.
Right.
And I think that's where.
Well, I think there's a level of impatience, which is what you're talking about, on both the listener as well as the talker, to kind of explain nuance. I do hear this a lot, you know, and maybe it's just the circles I run in. But I do think that people are, where they worry about our country is really kind of at a very different core level about, you know, fear and hate. That's what they worry the most about, is that they feel like there's just not room for like nuanced, patient, listening conversation that people, you know, it's like, and even if you say something that seems even somewhat controversial, you know, the side that doesn't want to be patient won't give you an opportunity to kind of like say your piece and explain like how you came to that conclusion.
And isn't that with the news that we consume right now, there's an expectation that you make
it's got to be a soundbite,
and you have to encapsulate everything in that one 5 minute, maybe five minute,
and
that's the long one on Fox or CNN.
I am guilty of this as well. I don't know if I told the story, but so candidate forum we had, I don't know, 2-3 weeks ago, something like that. So I tell folks like, I'm not perfect in these particular venues, but I feel like I'm relatively good at candidate forums. And I tell folks the reason why is because I've done lots of panels in my life, in my professional life, lots of them. If I've done I've probably not done hundreds of panels, but I've certainly done scores of panels.
Yeah,
and there've been many
scores. I scores. Love that word.
Well, you know, you got. Yeah, that's
because it can
word.
Be anything you want it to be.
No, it's not. It's called like 20 or so. What a score is like 20 or something like that.
Oh, so, I didn't know there was an scores. Official number.
So scores, like scores. 4 score is 80. And that's why when Lincoln talked about the Gettysburg Address. So come on, brush up on your history.
Sorry.
Score and 7 bad. Years ago, which would be 47.
What's that in Roman numerals?
It's XV, I think. No, XV. Wait a second.
XVII.
No, 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 no. 40 is you take 10 off of the other one. So what's 50? Is it X?
Is it a Y?
I think. What is it? X is a decade. What the hell is 50? Is it C? No, C is 100. I don't know. This is like testing my like third grade Roman numerals.
Wow.
This is, you know, I tell you what. There's two guys in Northern California. They invented this thing called Google, and that's what
the
we use.
The study
that for.
Of Roman numerals is not what it used to be.
It's not
in the public education system.
Well, you know, just want to let you know, not many people are using it anymore. In fact, I think the only place you encounter it,
Super Bowl.
Well, I was going to say, that's the only place you encounter it. Yeah. For some reason, the NFL has decided that that's how we're going to do that. All right. Well, you completely lost my train of thought. What was I talking about? I almost need to pause the pod and go back and see what I was talking about.
But
I was talking about panels.
We're talking about panels.
So
every newscast has to have a panel. Every story has to have a panel.
Well, I wasn't going to go there.
I don't get that.
I wasn't going to go there, but it actually is applicable in that environment as well. My goal when I used to do panels in the tech sector, my goal was to at least make sure that something I said got in print. Okay, that was goal number one. And then goal number two, which was a much higher level goal, is to make sure that my quote affects the headline of the article.
You're competing with the other members of the panel.
Yes, you are. And you're to get coverage. And what was interesting is that, so the one comment I said in that, and you can go watch it, so it's not like I'm breaking news here, but as I was talking about how the gun violence problem, really this is basically, you know, the source of this issue at the end of the day is money. And in fact, you know, the gun lobby and all this kind of stuff is affecting this thing. And what I said is that the way you're going to solve this problem is we need to go cut the legs off of the NRA.
I bet you got some oohs and some ahs and some boos on that one.
No, I got the thunderous applause. Oh, very, very
home crowd.
I was playing to the home crowd.
I gotcha.
Throw the crowd some red meat. Throw the crowd some red meat. Well, not only did that get the quote in the article, but it also was the headline.
I remember that dude retweeted that McCammon just said cut the legs off the NRA.
Yeah. So
you went for the soundbite.
I did
you
go for the soundbite.
You went for the repeatable phrase that was stuck in people's minds.
Exactly. So I'm raising my left or right hand. I'm not sure which. But yes, I am guilty, Your Honor.
But as humans, we're hardwired, I think, to we hear blah, 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 blah.
Three words.
That I relate to, I internalize, I remember what those are, blobbity, 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 blobbity.
Well, that's what advertising is all about. Like, you know, what's McDonald's current catchphrase?
I'm loving it.
I'm loving it. So that's what the part you don't remember the blobbity, blah, Big Mac-y, blah, 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 filet of fish, blobbity, blah.
I feel like every week
I'm loving it.
I admit something I hate. Last week was Disney. This week's McDonald's. I just spy.
You don't like McDonald's?
God, I hate McDonald's.
I'll tell you what.
Have you seen the app now that you can order from their app and pick it up?
No.
Or the kiosk ordering?
Because it takes too long at McDonald's to get your food?
No, because once again, as we've talked about, the only revolution in customer care is don't talk to anybody. Do it all yourself. Avoid us at all cost.
Well, that's what they've done that at Target and Walmart, too. So you've got the self-checkout lanes. And you know what? What drives me, I just want to rant on that, because I'm usually not an angry shopper like you are, but you know what? Don't show up at the help yourself like self-checkout with a cart of like 50 things.
Yeah.
For God's sake, people. Like there's a person that's a lot faster at this than you because they know where the barcodes are. Okay, like you're sitting there, you pull something out and it takes like 4 swipes to find the barcode. And it's like, okay, you're not scanning 50 things, you're scanning 200 things. Okay?
If you've got some cat food, a thing of milk, and a candy bar, that's what you run through.
That's not what you have for lunch, is it? Because that sounds like not a very good lunch.
No, that's not part of my diet, Mike.
Cat food.
But I think part of the thing, part of what we're talking about, too, in what stories get oxygen and what stories don't, is when I turn on MSNBC or I go to Huffington Post, I expect you to be part of my tribe. And I expect you to be feedbacking to me.
Well, there's a feedback.
The stories in my echo chamber.
Right, there's... Exactly. Well, it's called segmentation. Like when you know, if I like guns, you know, I don't walk into the store and pick up a Cosmo, like, because that's not going to be stuff I might be interested in.
No.
But if it's like whatever, I don't, what's guns and ammo or whatever the name of these article stories are.
The magazines today are like survivalist.
Yeah, those kind of things. Yes, and that would be stuff that would appeal to me. So it's no different than online. I mean, it's the same thing. It's like, okay, you know your audience. What are they looking for? And they want confirmation that their views are valid, mainstream, and logically thought through. So let's make sure we give them lots of that content to reconfirms that in their mind.
Jake Tapper on CNN is not going to do an extended segment, a 7-minute segment on things aren't as bad as you think.
Well,
they
I mean, even watching, I can't even remember the gal's name now because I've lost from conscious because we talked about her 2 weeks ago. But what was the gal on that? That said the stupid thing about the Parkland kid and like all the advertisers left.
Oh, Laura Ingraham.
Yeah, Laura Ingraham. So, there is a natural consequence of like, let's think about this. We just talked about it. So I have an online news program or podcast, or whatever. I have an audience. They're expecting a certain thing.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, you get advertisers that want to reach those people, right?
Yeah,
so it kind of that's the way this the economy of free content works. Well, now if all of a sudden, if I go off, you know, off the script and start talking about something that I don't, that doesn't appeal to people in my audience, now all of a sudden there's this backlash that the advertiser is like, okay, we're out of here.
Yeah.
So it's a reinforcing loop to kind of keep those people that have the discipline to keep talking about the same things
so,
all the time.
Mike, what I heard you say is from a revenue model for a cable news show, so to speak, let's say they have an established audience. And the strength of that show from an advertising perspective is that they consistently hold that audience.
Yeah.
Because if you consistently hold that audience, you consistently know who to go sell
advertising
to.
Exactly.
Because you can say, my audience is 35 to 49. Here's their demographic.
The reason why,
here's how they feel on these important issues.
The reason why Budweiser always signs up to do TV ads in the Super Bowl is because they have a fairly good assumption
of who
that,
they are.
That a lot of people watching the Super Bowl might buy beer.
So maybe as a news organization, if our goal was to present a wider breadth of stories and to pick stories that we went far deeper into.
It's called NPR.
To give better explanations. If in the commercial world, that would be very difficult to do.
I don't think
because it would change your revenue model.
Yeah, I think that I think there is a small segment of the population that love the serendipity of new information. But generally speaking, they don't.
They want to hear the same theme, the same story.
I've decided that guns are bad.
My train of thought. Guns are bad. Second Amendment should
keep
be outlawed.
Keep giving me good information so I can argue with my friends about guns are bad.
Keep feeding my loop. Keep me in my echo chamber. Go from here.
Don't tell me a story about some kid in Parkland that did a video shooting his AR-15. The transition to topic number two.
That's topic number two. But I think we want to end topic number one with, if you seek it out, there's some indicators that things aren't as disastrous
and by the way,
as they seem to be sometimes.
Well, and I'm going to tell you right now, and I'm going to be a little critical of your statistics. I think
I didn't give any statistics. I just made that up.
Okay.
There wasn't a single number I threw out there, Mike.
Okay, well, you gave me some statistics.
My anecdotes. I did that on purpose.
All right.
I said 1950.
Okay. Well, let's see. There you go. Summarized by saying is that it seems like you can go out and find good or bad statistics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in kind of any predicament, any situation probably. And I think it's easy to cherry pick 4 or 5 that say, okay, you know, New York is safer than London or, you know, those kind of things. But I do believe that the places where the country is very broken is kind of the morale of the country. It may, a lot of these things still may be going, but I do think people are generally sad that we don't get along as well as we should on a regular basis, and that, you know, they kind of had these manifestations of this when something happens and we all kind of get all tied about it and all that kind of stuff. I'm not making any sense. You're giving me
so
this sally face.
What
here,
you just did
scowling
is
face.
Part of the problem.
Oh, I did say that. I did. Oh, wow. Look at that.
You just became part of the problem. You took 4 or 5 things that were positive.
I'm sorry.
And instead of celebrating them as a positive, you immediately turned around to say, well, those 4 or 5 things that are positive don't matter because if you take them
That's
in
fair.
The totality, everything is still bad. That's number one. Then you took something.
Well, let me talk out of the other side of my mouth real quick.
Then you did the classic too. You took something that are concrete, that are provable. The murder rate in New York is trending. There were 333 murders, I think, last year, if I have my stat right, in New York, and we're trending less than that this year. That's a stat. That's math. That is provable. So then you took four or five stats that are trending in the right direction, and you equated it to something that can never be quantified, the morale and the morality of the country.
Yeah.
So instead of celebrating...
When I say morality, I'm not talking about like God or not God. I'm just talking about the moral.
But this is where we're at right now. Instead of saying there are some things that are provable and showable that we could grab onto as a positive, we threw it into this big ball of stew, and we're right back to where we are.
Yes, Dad. I'm sorry.
I'm just saying... and that's how... But that was a perfect example of how, if this were a CNN panel, and I was the, I guess I would play the conservative person here to say, listen, guys, not everything is going to hell in a handbasket. There are some things that we can point to. Then the next person on the panel would do it,
would have the response that you just did.
And then the third person on the panel would say, this is all linked to Trump, and we'd be right back to
let me turn this around and end on this. There is a deep, I think, underneath some of this, and I do see this, I talked to lots of people, I do see that there is a level of deep sadness.
Well, I agree with that.
That we can't come together on things.
Yeah.
And that is there. And so maybe I misspoke the way I was kind of defending my view, but I just want to report that is really there. And I'm asking myself, it's like, how do we fix that problem?
Yeah.
That kind of that low level hum of sadness that people have, that like, why can't we move forward on big things when it comes to our government? Why can't we not be proud of the people that serve us in government? Make us, for one time, make us proud. You know, let us sit back and be stunned by the wrong you tried to right for us.
Yeah.
Let us be proud of that. And I don't feel like that's there. I think there is just of a general sense of sadness that, you know, we should be able to get along. Well, and I tell people this all the time. It's like, this country can do anything that it wants to do. We have all the money, all the resources, the intellect. That's not true.
We've proven that over and over again.
The problem is that we don't have the will sometimes to do it. We don't make the choice to do it.
Which means we can't do anything.
We can't.
We argued this.
I'm an optimist.
No. We talked about this. This is the death knell at a small tech company. You're fighting every day that we can do whatever we want. No, I don't mean it from it.
I agree with that point, because we talked about the fact that and that's a different problem. When I say we can do anything we want, I say that if we decided that we wanted to solve this one problem, or actually the example I love to give, and I know it's kind of a little of an edge case, but if some set of people decide that we're going to put, you know, people on the moon, like, we can do that. You know, we have the will, we have the money, we have the resources. The problem is that there's problems in our country that I think some people don't, I mean, they say they wanted to solve them, but they don't really want to solve them. And that's the part that makes me frustrated, because what they want is the status quo, because a lot of times they're making money on the back channel, and they're not willing just to say, like, you know, here's a good example. If we wanted to outlaw bump stocks, that could happen. But sure. It won't. It just won't. It'll basically get referred to committee, and they'll never talk about it ever again.
So I would
come on. That's making a law to outlaw bump stocks is such a minuscule, small, universally accepted, we think we should do it thing. And the system is broken because the system doesn't want those things to change.
I'll change one word in that phrase which changes the equation completely. We can do anything we choose.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Okay, fair.
There's a very different from wanting to do and choosing to do.
Well, I agree with that.
Because if we're going to ban bump stocks, if we choose to do that, now I have to go to talk to the people that don't want to ban bump stocks.
And we've got to reach some
agreement to do it. The word "I want" drives me crazy, because "I want" is a fantasy.
So you're saying basically,
I want to lose 25 pounds. I am actively choosing to do nothing to pursue that activity. Now, I talk about this want all the time, but I still go to Quick Trip every morning. I'm still going out to lunch every day, and my exercise routine is falling to nothing.
Right.
So what I'm choosing to do is very different. That's what makes me nuts. And I'm so tired of talking about what we want.
So is that the...
Because adults make choices. What are we going to choose to do?
Right. And so it goes back to, as opposed to saying, I will?
Take out want and put the word in choose.
Or will. I will.
Because if you will,
and to go back to the analogy I use of the moon, you know, that's the, you know, iconic speech of the space age was John Kennedy's, that we choose to do these hard things.
We chose to do that. Right. Because when you choose to do something, next you have to put an action plan together.
Yeah, I'm all for that.
I'm planning to go to Paris one day. I'm not action planning that. We're not saving any money. I'm not convincing Joe this is what we should do.
Whereas if you said, we choose to go to Paris by the end of 2018.
Absolutely.
Now all of a sudden you got to start doing something about it.
Children want. Adults choose and plan. When do we make, that's what drives me nuts about that phrase is we got to stop wanting and we have to start choosing. Yeah. And how do we, and maybe one way to get there is maybe to acknowledge a few things that these things are better maybe or improving. How does that fit into the larger picture?
Well, I'll tell you what, I didn't wake up with a smile on my face, but I have one now because things are getting better. America is great again.
You're energized to face the world in an America that is charging towards greatness again.
Yes. We are going a little long.
Oh, so I know. I'm very time conscious, Mike.
I know. We're just... So,
but no, we've talked about the strength of the pod is the long format.
Yeah, well, and I like the little speech you gave earlier today before we started.
I feel like you just reached over and tousled my hair a little, if I had any, and said, good speech, son.
Well, you know, we were talking about it, and don't want to swing back to the campaign for a minute, but it would be really interesting, like we said, to have a long format, actual, like, brass tacks type of interview of all the candidates that
absolutely.
Are running for any office for that matter, and really not let people get out of like the kind of stock answers that, you know, like you got your little play track that you always play back and really push people to and not just push them from the standpoint of like having to answer a question, but push them into a place that and also, and by the way, we need to give the candidates some room to be reflective too. Because like a lot of times, like, okay, if you don't, you know, the format of a candidate forum is basically, okay, how well have you rehearsed the answers to be able to like immediately fire back? You know, not only do I have like the memorable statement, but I'm very knowledgeable and have done all the research on this. But it's kind of a, you know, you'd never know exactly what you're going to get. So it's really kind of more of a measure of your ability to memorize stock answers for the most likely questions and getting lucky to get the right questions. And as opposed to sitting there, like if someone asks you a question, and if you sat there for a second and said, you know what? I haven't thought of that before.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be like the worst thing you could possibly do. And we don't give the candidates time to do that
in
either.
In this long podcast format with the candidates, if you wanted to give an answer and then 10 minutes later you want to come back and say, you know, I heard some other people talk about that. I'd like to update my answer. Right. That's totally acceptable.
But it's not really in politics though.
So we want to do this. We want to do a podcast with all six candidates, and I've already raised my hand to be the moderator.
Yeah, I don't think that's going
to happen. We need to do this in public. This would be awesome. Because as the moderator, the first thing, we would explain the rules of the game.
Well, the problem would be is no one would agree to this because they know you'd be a softie with me, and then you'd like be
behind
everybody else.
No, you're going
to
get it double. But there's
well, then I don't want to do it either.
There are rules of the game, and the only rule of the game is you ask the question that is answered to you. If you do not answer the question that's asked to you, myself as the monitor will say, sir or ma'am, that didn't answer the question. Would you like another opportunity to answer the question that was asked? And if you say no, or if you start repeating your talking point, we will simply go to the next person. Ma'am, Mike is not answering you like to answer it?
Yeah, well, I think the format would be better. I think you would just have to have one candidate at a time, but let's not talk about the logistics of this because this is just inside baseball.
Oh, we could do it. We could totally do it.
I think it would be very useful to... Well, and we talked about this. I mean, I think that the tendency of, again, the way content goes these days, it, you know, we only have 20 minutes to talk, so if you ramble on for 5 minutes on a talking point... You know, that's all we're going to get because we're never going to like extend the format to get like a real answer.
Yeah. Have you heard of Jordan Peterson, the professor out of Toronto?
Now, I try to avoid most things from Canada.
I love
totally,
Canada.
Totally a joke. Totally a joke.
He's been labeled kind of an alt-right conservative. I don't think that label fits him.
I love Canada. In fact, my family...
Winnipeg was fantastic.
My family first came to this continent through Canada, so I have to be a fan of Canada.
So your family came through Canada, saw the mountains and the resources of Canada, and said, you know, this looks good, but I've heard about this place, Kansas, which is flat. We can live in a grass hut, and locusts are probably going to drive us out. Let's keep walking.
I would venture to
bet. Let's find that place.
I would venture to bet in the early 1800s, immigration decisions were based on low amounts of information, because I don't think that they had
bears chasing us.
Well, I'm just saying they have low information.
Yeah, these people don't like us, are going to shoot us, so we got to keep moving.
You know, they didn't Google Kansas and like go do a street view to find out what it really looked like.
They're like, damn, this does look as good as I thought. Somebody painted like a picture of they just drew a straight line on a piece of paper.
Exactly.
Here's where you want to be.
Yeah, I don't know.
You get mad every time I rip into Kansas.
You know, Kansas is a great place. My family's here, you know, five generations. So, all right. Well, let's wrap some of these things up. Because
we were talking. Hold on. Jordan Peterson. Jordan Peterson is this controversial alt-right guy. The main thing that happened was him, and he was interviewed by a liberal professor at the University of Toronto.
Right.
They did this 5 to 7 minute kind of interview that was edited, and where the person asked him questions, kind of leading him towards the answers and to give the type of answer she wanted so she could label him a certain way.
Right.
Contradict that with my favorite podcast, I've said this before, is Joe Rogan. If you really want to know what Jordan Peterson thinks and what he's about and what his views are, go listen to the 3.5 hours he talks to Joe Rogan. And this is where...
Man, you have so much time.
No, you just do it during the day. This is what we've talked about, how new forms of media and streaming services are destroying traditional news outlets and the way people consume their news. The fact that I would have to be at my TV at a certain time of night to watch a program.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where you feed me 12 minutes of short bit information, followed by 4 minutes of commercials for hemorrhoids or buying gold because when the economy crashes, we need to go back to the gold standard,
right,
is ridiculous. This is my point. If you really want to know what somebody thinks, feels, and does, don't go by what you see on major news networks. You got to find these alternative sources, podcasts being one of them, to really get that long format.
And to be honest, I will give you this for sure. The one thing that is a benefit of a podcast is that there really is no time limit. I mean, we could basically talk for the next, and we're not going to, for the next 4 hours, and we could post this online. And if someone wanted to, they could climb their whole way through it if they wanted.
So, Joe Rogan does 4.5 hours with Alex Jones. Alex Jones is the InfoWars.
Yeah, I know that guy.
It is the 4 hours. I can't describe how entertaining it is. And it veers from informational to comedic.
Does he ever get
absolute craziness?
Does Alex ever find a reflective moment? I mean, does he get caught in that to say, hadn't thought of that? Or is he
for
just
every
got
one thing he says that makes you go, okay, I guess there might be a path to that. He overpowers it with
20
things,
20 other things
that are like, that's just the most insane thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. All right, so why don't we combine these last two topics into one, because they're kind of the same. So there's this kind of like, and unfortunately the measure of this is like how many followers you get on Twitter and people leave you. So, you know, Kanye West and then what's the kid's name in Parkland? I can't remember his name.
Kyle Kashov?
Kyle. So if you have kind of a narrative that's going along a path, and you come out with something that completely contradicts that path, should you be assassinated on social media because you're now like not one of us or something like that?
So Kanye comes out and...
Now, by the way, let's start off by saying that part of being a celebrity is standing out. So,
correct.
So the most extreme things you can do sometimes actually increase your value as a celebrity.
I Googled Kanye West last night.
Exactly.
I mean... That's not something I typically do.
Yeah.
But I think, so Kanye West came out over the last week and he's busted out a series of pro-Trump tweets, and he's given some props to Candace Owens, I believe, she is an alt-right provocateur is how I would describe her. There was a video where she's at a rally and she shouts down a Black Lives Matter representative. And Conway tweets out, "I love the way Candace Owens thinks."
Right.
And then that starts some tweets about Trump, which gets to Conway showing his MAGA hat signed by Trump. So allegedly, and this is in dispute, he lost 9 million Twitter followers over the course of this 3 to 4 or 5 day run,
right,
where he busted out these tweets. The greatest part of this story is the Washington Post. I think there was an op-ed where they labeled Kanye West as alt-right.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So if you're old enough to be aware of the news when Katrina hit, and if you remember the celebrity fundraiser for Katrina after the hurricane, Kanye West was the guy who yelled out on national television, "George Bush doesn't like black people." Remember that?
Yes.
When he's standing next, I think it was next to Mike Myers, and he busted that out. To somehow now that we're labeling Kanye West alt-right, that is kind of bizarre, head-scratching, well, see, and ridiculous.
This thing of celebrity is kind of a game, because so Kanye West wants to get coverage so that people pay attention to him, right? Then if you're the commentator that calls him the alt-right, people are going to pay attention to you.
Sure.
So this is all about ratings and celebrity. It's theater. It's not real.
So maybe this is what happens when everybody is building a brand these days. If we're taking a cynical approach to the Parkland students, you can say that David Hogg,
Gonzalez,
they are building a brand. They are building a.
Do you think they're doing
set
that
of values that they're tying to themselves that then they will go out and present in the social realm?
Yeah.
And Kanye West for years has done that. He has built this brand around his music, his imagery, his shoes. He's the one who's got the Yeezys that are like the $3,000 shoes.
Yeah.
If you can see the look Mike just gave me when I busted out Yeezys. My point is, so these are things that...
You don't have a pair, do you, by the way? Just to set the record straight.
Okay. No, I do not. Allegedly, some kid that goes to my kid's school has them. I'm like, trust me, kid in Platte County has a pair of $3,000 shoes. That's not going to happen. But this is what happens, I think, when Kanye West went counter to his brand, that always has some sort of consequence. And in business, those are usually monetary. You sell less, you lose advertisers, whatever that may be. In the social branding, which I think is what this is, your currency is your influence, your Twitter followers.
Right, right.
And when you go off brand, you kind of lose. That's how you lose your monetization.
Now, by the way, I'm not going to say it was a calculation, but it may have been a calculation to grow his audience too. So,
I think what's so interesting about Kyle Kashev, if I'm saying that right, he's a sophomore at Parkland. He was there for the shooting. He is pro Second Amendment. So as the larger group of kids have gone out and done everything that they've done for gun control, which fully support, think it's great,
right,
I have no problem with that, he has presented the alternate side of the Second Amendment approach to solving the problem. So he has received far less attention. So I think as he sees those kids going out and building their brand, and building their brand for the causes that they believe, he has started building his brand as somebody who supports Second Amendment rights.
Right.
And seeking out the same opportunities that brand offers him. He's talked to Senator Rubio. He's talked to the other Democratic senator in Florida, I think Nelson, that nobody remembers his name.
He'll probably end up talking to the NRA convention, would be my guess.
He's been on Ben Shapiro. He's been on conservative podcast and news media. This week, he posted to Twitter a video of him and his dad going to a local shooting range and shooting an AR-15. that in itself is somewhat distasteful, seeing what he has been through and what the school has been through. He absolutely has the right to do it. He broke no laws.
Right.
He absolutely has the legal right to do that. And he was under the supervision of his dad. I have no problem with him going to a gun range and firing a weapon. The posting of the video, I think, is part of building his brand and showing the counter brand of the kids that are gun control.
This is another view on this issue.
I am building an alternate view and tying an alternate set of values to my name, to my social presence, to build my brand.
Right.
Now, a lot of kids at Parkland were upset by this. They kind of alerted school administration. He was pulled out of class and interviewed, a criminal style interview with the school resource officer and a member of the Broward County Sheriff's Department.
Well, I mean, they're obviously kind of a little bit on alert, you would think, in that community at this point in time.
I would think so. So we were just talking about, you know, one is, you know, he's building his counter brand to what's happening on the other side of the aisle. And number one is, how is that distasteful to post that video? Is it insensitive?
You know, I mean, it goes back to, you know, while I may not agree with you, I agree with your right to say it. You know,
absolutely.
It's just kind of the First Amendment kind of a thing. So, you know, was it the most sensitive thing to do? Probably not. But should the person be able to do that?
Sure.
I mean, that's kind of the way this is supposed to work, right? Because if you start editing, then the question is, well, who's the editor?
And where do you stop?
Right, exactly.
And should the police been called and pulled him out of class and put him through?
Well, I would assume, and of course, the story is kind of left the national headlines, but the sense I got from a lot of my friends that are gun supporters is that they were telling me that, you know, there were a lot of mistakes made by people in government in Florida.
In the Broward County Sheriff's Department, absolutely.
Well, I wasn't going to be too specific, but leading up to the tragedy at Parkland. So, you know, I guess they probably are overreacting at this point because it's like, okay, we're not going to have this kind of scrutiny going forward. So if a kid does this, then we're going to... I mean, I'm not trying to excuse it because it is wrong. And it's, you know... This will be it's been the challenge of the country, you know, since it started, was like, you know, where do you draw the lines on these types of things? And, you know, allowing people to live the life they want to live is kind of what this country is built on a little bit.
Yeah. So part of it is, you know, should he have posted the video? Was it insensitive to post? I think we all both agree that, probably.
Yeah, I think that given the dynamic in that part of the country at this point in time, how does that further the conversation? But I guess, you know, I would say that, you know, if you're in a position where you have an alternate view of things and the world's going a certain direction, sometimes you feel compelled to tell your part of the story. And so, like, not to prolong the podcast today, but I mean, I've been reading that the Supreme Court's leaning that they may actually start, you know, defending Trump's ban on immigration, which is something that I would just completely disagree with. So the question would be is, okay, if we kind of take the same thing and put this lens on this other thing, is it irresponsible for me to do a video talking about why immigration's good when the country is moving in this other direction, apparently, if that makes any sense? I mean, it's kind of and the argument would be is, you know, you should have the right to tell people what you think. And by the way, the one thing that people need to do is have take on the responsibility that they know that if they're going to do this, there may be kind of a backlash.
Absolutely. You know, you have to accept that backlash.
Exactly. That is a consequence of a decision you make. And sometimes people think that there should be no consequences. And I think that's where we get in trouble is when people say, well, I should be able to say this and I don't give a shit what you think. Well, yeah, I mean, you have the ability to say that, but you need to remember other people may be offended by it.
And I think, too, I'm more interested now in kind of always analyzing who is the adult in the room, who is the person that through when something like this is unfolding, that somebody needs to think through what are the consequences to this? How is this going to impact people?
Right.
Who is that person who should have said, while we have the right to do this? And while, yes, maybe this counter position to what's happening out there is important. Let's figure out the best way and the most adult way to do this.
Well, and I think a lot of times people also, I tend to think that they forget, well, not necessarily forget, but they don't ask themselves, like, where are we trying to go?
What's the end game?
What's the destination here? And then figure out how do your actions fit into moving everyone towards that end goal, as opposed to just kind of a reaction, you know, and saying, there's a, well, I won't get too much into Buddhism, but there was a podcast I listened to a long time ago that basically said, it's not, you know, the way that we live our lives is we tend to react to things and we don't take the time to choose how we're going to respond to things. And that's different. And maybe this was a calculation, you know, maybe this is what they want to do. And I perfectly, you know, I support what they've done. You know, they have the right to do that. But we also, the other side now, we need to choose how we're going to respond, you know, to that video as well.
So what, one adult reaction in the room could have come from the police, that instead of going down to the school and pulling him out, we're going to call his dad.
Right.
And we're going to have a conversation with his dad. And then his dad is going to bring, if that conversation goes well and reasonable, his dad's going to bring him in and we're going to talk to them about the video and assess what happens.
Right.
Another adult in the room could have been his dad who said, son, I know where you're going. I get where you're going with this. I even support where you're going with this. Do you understand the consequences of how people are going to react to this? And maybe this happened, but let's take 5 to 10 minutes to talk about what you're doing, why you're doing it, and the reaction you want to get. And is this the way to do it? And I just don't think people do that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's good to, I mean, I think it's necessary for parents to come in and basically help children find, and it depends on the parents too, you know, same kind of a thing. So, you know, we've had learning moments with our kids when it came to, you know, when they've taken something out of the convenience store without realizing they have to pay for it first when they're like 5 years old. And what's that teachable moment? You know, there was a teachable moment I remember with one of our sons when he was about 7 years old, when he was ridiculing a girl that lived in the cul-de-sac because she couldn't like shoot the basketball as good. And that's a teachable moment there.
That's a teachable moment.
And so, yeah, I agree that the adult needs to be in the room. So who's Kanye West's adult before we leave the pod today?
I don't know. Kanye, I keep calling him like Conway.
Conway.
It's not Conway Twitty. Kanye is his own adult. And I think that's the other.
Well, I think, and I'll tell you, I don't give celebrities a pass, but they are in the business of being notable.
Yeah.
So I don't, when I see them do anything, it never surprises me that, or I never don't go to the place, well, maybe they're just doing it to get some attention. And because that's the whole point of what they do, is to get attention, to become celebrity, to build their brand, to get more people to pay attention to
them. And
this
idea that you follow Kanye West on Twitter and you know his music and you watch his videos or whatever, the idea that that means you know him in somehow is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the fact that because his brand is X, as a human being now, he has no right to change or to think differently or to explore different lines of thought. That's as equally ridiculous.
Well, and again, it's this is the adulting, if you will, of society, is that, you know, once you get that kind of celebrity, there's a responsibility that goes along with that. You know, it's like,
why?
Well, I think
because you're a celebrity.
No, I'm just saying is that there's a response. I mean, it's just that if you're going to be an adult, you say, okay, other people are watching me, and I need to be conscious of that. So my behavior should, you know, reflect a conscious level of that. I mean, and I guess you don't have to, but I guess if I were ever lucky enough to have that kind of celebrity, I would think through the words that I say and how does it affect people's lives, and hopefully that it doesn't in a positive way as opposed to negative.
I think you're pointing out a massive change in society. I think 50 years ago, before technology kicked in, it was all I expect out of Kanye West is to occasionally drop a new album.
Well, that's true. It. Well, I agree with that.
Now, suddenly, because this man has the ability to entertain me, I've assigned him, I've willingly given him all of these other influencers. What if every
Well, and
time,
I would say, and let's personalize this to say that because I like your album, I've allowed you to 3 times a day interrupt my mental state with your point of view on things that probably have nothing to do with making an album.
Correct. And because I like your album, now I'm assigning you all of these other higher level
Yeah, that's true.
Attributes.
Well, this goes back. They've talked about this with sports too. Athletes are like, you know, like, hey, like I'm just an athlete. You know, I'm a quarterback. Like I, you know,
what's wrong with that?
Right. I'm just a quarterback, and it doesn't, you know. And this is a question all the back is, okay, well, is there a responsibility of being a celebrity that you need to do things because people are watching it, that whole thing? And
yeah, I guess I'm just down on that whole thing. If you assign Kanye West, I can't say that. If you assign Kanye West political authority because he has an album, you're an idiot. I'm sorry. That's on you.
Yeah, he's an artist.
Yes. If you've elevated
not a lawmaker.
If you've elevated him to political and social commentator, that's your bad.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to this week's podcast, and be sure to subscribe to your favorite store. Visit our website, the2menintheMiddle.com, for historical episodes and more about the podcast. Likewise, you can find us on Twitter at the2menintheMiddle for show updates and upcoming episodes. Thanks for stopping by and have a great week.